People of Adland, do you know how many listeners you can reach by advertising on a Muddy Knees Media podcast? Loads! Every single episode of Galazzo alone is listened to by nearly 100,000 of those hard-to-reach 25 to 44-year-old men. But we do plenty more shows than that now. We've got The Offside Rule with Kate Borsay, Lindsay Hooper and Hayley McQueen. We've got The Offside Rule WSL Edition, the UK's premier women's football podcast. We've got Series Linked, a podcast that's dripping with celebrities. And then there's the rest of the Totally Football Network, which includes the very lovely thetotallyfootballshow.com. If you'd like to talk about advertising with Muddy Knees Media, drop us a line on sales@muddyneesmedia.com. That's sales@muddyneesmedia.com. And listeners, don't keep the show to yourself. Leave us a review, rate us, share it with your friends, and subscribe wherever you listen to the rest of your podcasts and never miss an episode.
Today on Golazzo, we're talking the little club that's had more stars per capita than anywhere in Italy. And more scandals too, but still the absolute lowest travelling support anywhere in the game. It's Udinese. It's Udine in the northeastern corner of Italy, just a short drive from Slovenia, not far from Austria. In fact, 100 years ago, this was Austria, which may be why, on special days, people wander the streets of Udine in lederhosen and feathered hats, making middle European beats like this and saying things like,
Mondi, James. Cemut le bighe?
That's James Horncastle. Is that a bit of Friuliano?
Yes. Hi, James. How are you?
In Friuli?
Yeah, in Fulans.
Ah, right, okay, which is the local dialect. Gab Marcotti is also here.
I am shocked. I do not speak the regional accent.
Do you James speak is special. Latin? Is it Latin as well?
No, ah, Latin is Alto Adige, no?
Yeah.
But I think it is spoken in parts of Friuli. Yeah.
Basically, listen, we're up in the northeast of Italy at this point where things have got pretty mixed up geopolitically over the last couple of centuries and languages with them. So, yeah, there's a whole bunch of other stuff. There's Slovenian mixed in, what did you call it?
Fulans.
Fulans. And there's certainly a lot of German or Germanic languages and all sorts of things. It's a special area. And Gab, I want to say that it's home to a very special club.
It's home to Udinese.
Mm.
Udinese is a city, I think it's about like 80,000 people.
So it's the 47th biggest city in Italy, right? I mean, people forget this because there are loads and loads of cities that, like Livorno, for example, is much bigger.
But it's not just the 47th biggest. I mean, like Sesto San Giovanni is like three times as large, right?
Yeah.
But it's also the fact that there's nothing around it. It's not like it's a city that's like an hour away from a major
Pordenone.
City. No, but what I mean is, like, this is pretty rural stuff here
frontier.
That we're talking about.
Yeah.
It's half the size of Parma, for example, who are often regarded as the great example of a tiny club that makes it big.
But they don't have an opera house as beautiful as Parma.
No, they don't. What they do have is a lot of barracks. With Udine, I always think of that's one of the defining things of the town. It's an army town, isn't it?
I think historians have kind of argued that this is where cannons were used for the first time.
Really?
Not Udine. In Udine, but around that area
right.
In a battle.
Okay.
Back in, I think, the 14th century or something like that. Wow. I probably wildly.
But I defer to you and you with your four lunch.
So the thing about the people from this area, the stereotype, and I'm just like,
Dino Zoff.
The most famous Friulano is Dino Zoff, born in 1942 in Mariano del Friuli, which is just a hop, skip, and a jump away. These are people who are generally slightly introverted just simply because, you know, they're people of few words. They're
right.
Very simple people. If they were into furniture, they'd be shakers.
I see. They're people of few words and words that generally begin with the letter Z. Certainly that's the case in our story today as we look back at Udinese, known as the Zebretti, the little zebra, a story that will take in such diverse figures as Zanussi, Zaccheroni, and one in particular, Zico.
Arriva Zico, il nuovo amico, che ogni domenica ha un asso nella manica, un
Artur Antunes Coimbra Zico to his friends like us, who moved to this far-flung corner of Italy in 1983 in a move that caused some surprise. The number one player in the world leaving Flamengo for the little town of Udine. How did this happen?
There's a lot going on here, a lot of moving parts, because you have Lamberto Zanussi.
Mm-hmm. Lamberto Mazza,
who's the head of Zanussi.
The electrodomestic, kind of the white goods industry.
Yeah, I have a
industry.
Zanussi washing machine.
There you go.
I had to have it serviced a few weeks ago.
They were massive in the 80s as well. Zanussi.
They were massive, but at this stage, James, they're about to make all kinds of layoffs. I think they're about to make 4,500 people redundant. And at this stage, they think it's a great idea to go and spend a lot of money on Zico. Zanussi only had so much money that he could budget for Udinese and pay for a player like Zico. And so the idea was to meet the asking price from Flamengo, which was, what, 6 billion lira?
6.2 billion.
Okay, there you go.
According to contemporary accounts.
Was to set up a company, which I think had offices in London and Switzerland. And when they went to the London address, I think it was a church or something like that.
Right.
And say, look, we're going to pay you the four million up front, but the rest of it, we're going to do it through this 4 billion. The rest of it, we're going to, you know, raise from sponsorships. Like, we're going to get Coca-Cola to come on board. We're going to get Adidas to come on board. We're going to get all these companies to come on board. And we're going to sell his image rights to Mediaset. And this is how we're going to pay for this.
Right. But if there's one thing the Italian football authorities can't stand, it's financial irregularities. So they said, no, we're not convinced that you have the means to pay for Zico, so we're not going to let you sign him.
And they got a little bit lucky because at the same time, the Fijici came down on Roma's move for Tonino Cerezo.
Oh, right.
And yeah, according to people at Udinese, it was actually, no, they were making an example of Roma and Tonino, who were late in getting the paperwork done for that, than for Zico. But luckily for them, the guy who wanted Tonino to sign for Roma was a certain Andreotti. And Andreotti basically says, right, Fijici, do what you have to do. Just let Roma sign Tonino Cerezo. And that allowed Zico.
Which is a good thing, because if not, the entire region would have split and gone to Austria, Gabriele.
You mentioned Andreotti. To contextualize it, I know you like films.
Yes.
Giulio Andreotti is this sort of extraordinary figure. He was Italian prime minister sort of, I think, eight times as part. He's a Christian Democrat. He had a big hunchback and thick glasses and weird ears that stuck out. And
if there's a mystery or controversy, he's at the heart of it.
Yeah, he's... So just two reference things you might have seen. One is the movie Il Divo. Which
magnificent
is,
film.
Before Il Divo... If you remember, there was a famous Italian miniseries called La Piovra. I think English it was called Octopus Power of the Mafia.
Yeah.
Where they made, like, with starring the very handsome Michele Placido, where I think they made like four or five series. And then it kind of like the plot, and it implies that there is a person at the center of everything.
The puppet master.
Is it Luciano Moggi?
No.
Oh.
But people have obviously drawn the Moggi Andreotti parallel.
Right.
And that. It was this guy.
Right.
It was Giulio Andreotti. And the fact that he was responsible for, ultimately, and maybe perhaps indirectly, for Zico, I mean, the second greatest
possibly
football in the world.
As a statesman, because he realized that the people in Udine were serious when they took to the streets, as they did, of that northeastern town, chanting Zico or Austria. Either you give us our fancy Brazilian signing, or we're going to hightail it to another country.
And instead of the waltz, they got the samba in
Brilliant.
The end, James. Nice. But like the thing is, like this part of Italy had been severely disrupted, devastated, you might say, by an earthquake, what, a few years before. And Zico, I think, had come over to play in a charity game. And he was telling this story about how the Brazilian government, I think, or the Brazilian FA were very reluctant to let the players go. And it was only whilst they were in the departure lounge that they got the kind of paperwork to sign off on them going. Presumably it's some kind of insurance thing. So again, he all thinks this is some kind of destiny that he would end up in Udine, which again, I think is testament to the strength and depth of Italian football at that time, where this has to be one of the greatest transfers of all time, that Zico could go to Udinese.
Juninho Tabara would be the example in the UK. But
Zico was the second best player in the world at the time. right? As much as I love Juninho, Juninho Paulista, I've even been to his pizzeria in Sao Paulo and blah, blah, blah. He's little and cute and pleasant. Like, he was never the second best player in the world. He's not even the second best player from Sao Paulo. He's not even the second best short player in the world. He's not even, he may be the second best Brazilian named Juninho. I will give him that one after the free kick specialist. But yeah, this would be like, take your pick, Messi or Ronaldo, whoever you think is second best, you know, moving to Bournemouth.
Just let that sink
but
in.
His first game, James.
Yes.
Against Genoa.
Yep.
5-0 win. And just people go crazy. He scores 8 free kicks. And one of the great stories about Zico whilst he was at Udinese is he's in training, he's doing his free kicks, and he keeps hitting the bar. And he's like, something's off here. You know, I think this goal isn't kind of regulation kind of dimensions. And so he goes over to the kit man, or whoever was in charge of that, and he says, look, I keep hitting the bar free kicks. I always score these free kicks. There must be something wrong with your goalposts. And the guy goes and measures it up, and he's like, Zico, you're absolutely right. They're 5 centimetres lower than they should be.
Incredible. 2 seasons he spends there. 79 appearances he makes, 57 goals, and this was not a free-scoring time in Serie A. And pretty special game to finish as well. Do you remember how it all came to an end? So this is May the 12th, 1985, when, as fate would have it, Udinese, with Zico discussing what he's going to do, will he come back to Udinese? It looks pretty unlikely. Are facing Napoli. So you have Zico against the Neapolitans with this new young Argentine fellow, Maradona. And the match really lives up to expectations. Maradona opens the scoring after just 4 minutes with a free kick. L'Argentino di mettersi in evidenza, ecco che parte il suo tiro. Splendido, ed è gol. Ha pennellato la sua esibizione Maradona subito in apertura con questo splendido gol, la quale Udinese equalised from a Zico free kick, which is turned in after a bit of a goal mouth scramble. Then in the second half, there's an absolutely extraordinary free kick by Luigi De Agostini. Parte invece Edinho, anzi tocco è per De Agostini. Grande svento, e gol! Incredible kind of South American style thunderbolt from miles outside the area. And then the final goal, 2-2, Maradona equalises with a hand of God. Long hoof upfield, he goes up, collects it, and then leaps over and appears to head it, but he's actually punching it in, as in he would famously do not long after against England. Zico afterwards on 90th minuto, really not holding back.
I imagine they went to town on that on Il Processo.
I'm sure they did. Yeah. You work all week and this guy comes along and robs everyone. È una cosa incredibile.
Oh, the other thing about Udinese, when they had Zico, is like, we have to make as much kind of money out of this as possible. You know, this is a great opportunity. A little bit like, say, what Juventus have been doing with Cristiano Ronaldo, but on a different scale altogether. And they did all these kind of innovative things. I mean, this predates Zico as well, but they were, I think, were the first Italian club to have sponsors on their shorts, and they kind of broke the way through for that. They had a sort of jumbotron at the Friuli, which was the biggest kind of screen that was at an Italian stadium at the time. And then they had halftime entertainment as well around this, where they had some of the biggest and most popular singers basically come and entertain.
Miani, the I wonder if he was there playing his big Sanremo hit, Rebelle su questa terra. One can only hope so. Sounds a little bit like this. Damn.
That was the best thing I've found on YouTube in a long time, I think.
Miani. Just amazing. All right, well, so that was Zico, and he left, and basically he never went back because he was being chased by the tax authorities over a bunch of unpaid money. He's gone back since, but certainly didn't return to play at Udinese. And that was kind of one version of Udinese under Mazza. But the one that we're more familiar with is all about Pozzo. And it's the one that defines Udinese as I understand them.
Father and son.
Yeah, Giampiero Pozzo and Gino Pozzo. So Giampiero Pozzo buys the club from Lamberto Mazza in 1986. Now, previously, through their history, they've been kind of yo-yoing up and down between top division and even as low as the third. One excellent season in 54-55 when they got to second place, but were subsequently done for combine, for match fixing in that period. In fact, they were sent down for fixing a 3-2 last day win in the early 50s. In 79-80, they were dot points as part of the Calcio Scommessi. And in fact, when Pozzo was buying them from Mazza, they were in the process of being docked 9 points as part of the Totonero scandal. Anyway, he comes in and starts what has become heralded as one of the most far-sighted and well-run football clubs in Italy. First with a scouting program and a really, really comprehensive global network of scouts, and first in many other ways as well.
Yeah, so the scouting program, which Giampiero Pozzo's obviously older now, but he's been old for a while now. And he's sort of like the patriarch with the white hair and the beard. And it's really his son, Gino, who just drives everything and probably even at a very young age drove it at the start. So they pushed the scouting network. They told me at the time, I don't know, these things kind of go up and down, that, you know, they spend more on scouting than all but sort of 4 or 5 clubs in the world. One of their big strengths is they scout. They look where other people do not, and they look at a very, very young age. And people thought that there's some secret sauce, or it must be the director of football or whatever, but these guys have come and remember for a while there was this guy, Leonardi, who took all the credit for everything. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, he moves and, no, look, he moves and he's rubbish. So it's obviously not him, you know? I mean, one of their successes, one of the most obvious examples is Alexis Sanchez, who, you know, they signed him, I think, when he was 16 or 17. I think he'd been on loan in Argentina.
Yeah, they keep him on loan for a while before they bring him over.
Yeah, but they signed him for 2.5, well, it would have been illegal.
I think a million euro?
No, I think it's more than that. I think it was about 2.5 million pounds, 3 million, which for them is a huge advance. And think about it, that's when the guy's 16 years old.
Right.
Like, this is the sort of thing Real Madrid does, chucks so much money. But they did that because they were sure. And they were sure because Alexis is from a town called Tocopilla or something like that, up in the north of Chile, near the border with Peru. They had basically known him, his family, his aunts and uncles, his pets, all his coaches, from the time he was...
Particularly his pets, I'm guessing.
Particularly his pets, yeah. From the time that he was 10 years old. That is how capillary the network is. So when other clubs... We started making a name for himself at Colo-Colo, and other clubs came in for him. All of a sudden, you know, there's Real Madrid walking through the door. There's Manchester United, you know, everybody wanting a piece of El Niño Maravilla, even though he was still very, very young. And yet they were able to leverage their long-standing relationship with his family because they first came into his life when he was 10 or 11 years old. And they've done this everywhere, all over the globe, and they've done it with tremendous, tremendous success. So the $3 million were for the club, but, you know, he could have still said, no, screw this. Right. I want to go to Real Madrid.
And
but
how much did they sell him for in the end to Barcelona?
It was only 26 million, but at the time, 26 million was a lot of money.
You look at some of the other deals, Iaquinta, who they got for, I think, 100,000 euros, sold for about 11 million. Suliali Montari, they picked up for 200k euros, sold for 12 million. Davide Pizzaro, what a player, 300,000 euros they got him for and sold him for 12 million. Just so many. People love to play that game. Imagine if they hadn't sold all their best players. But the first 11 you could make out of the players who've been through their gates, Abel Balbo, Nesta Sensini, Zico, of course, we mentioned Pizarro. Oliver Bierhoff, Handanovic, Di Natale, Fiore, Qualiarella.
Just to key in on a couple of those names, Di Natale was signed for like 100 grand from Empoli. Handanovic was free from Domžale in Slovenia. And Bierhoff had been a guy who played second division football for Ascoli for a few years. And they picked him up for, I think, 1 million. And then they sold him to Milan for 12 and a half. So,
let's talk then about Bierhoff and that Zaccheroni Udinese side. Bierhoff, who'd not been a particular success in Germany and even at Ascoli, I remember the famous story of him getting beaten up at the traffic lights because the club weren't doing well.
He's a big man, by the way. Mm. Yeah. So it took a lot of people. Or a very brave person.
Of course, by 96, he's a slightly bigger name because he's won Euro 96 for Germany.
A winner in the final.
Right. Against the Czech Republic. He scored twice, didn't he? Came on, scored twice, I think.
Scored the golden goal.
But the following season, he's part of an absolutely extraordinary match. The defining game, certainly of Zaccheroni's great period, Alberto Zaccheroni, at that club. So this is 13th of April 1997, and Udinese was still a pretty modest kind of regional entity. Traveled to the toughest ground in Italy, the Stadio delle Alpi, to take on Juventus. Within a couple of minutes, they get a man sent off, at which point pretty much any manager is going to take off a forward and just try and keep it tight, stave off the inevitable. Zaccheroni stuns the nation by leaving his team exactly as they are. It's a defender who's been sent off, so they're now playing 3-3-3 with Poggi, Amoroso and Bierhoff up front. And while Italy listens incredulous at the Radiolino, they start scoring goals. 1, 2, 3 strikes at the Stadio delle Alpi.
Finisce il primo tempo in questo istante con l'Udinese in vantaggio per 1-0. Amoroso al 42esimo. Tiro fa raddoppiato per l'Udinese dopo 1 minuto e 30 secondi di gioco di inizio della ripresa. Dunque 2-0 per l'Udinese sulla Juventus qui a Torino. Amoroso.
Gentili.
Eh sì, Amoroso ha portato a 3 il punteggio a favore dell'Udinese. Azione personale esattamente al terzo minuto.
At this point Juve start to get given penalties. They miss one. Vieri misses that. And then Turchi, the Udinese keeper, saves from Zinedine Zidane. And oh my word, it's a monumental 3-0 win.
Former Cremonese goalkeeper Turchi, who famously played with the legendary Alviero Chiorri, who Gianluca Vialli reckons as one of the most talented players he'd ever seen.
Really?
Wow.
Yes, and Mancini gets very angry when you bring it up because he says, what about me? What anyway, about that's a digression. So you mentioned there Marcio Amoroso, and his story, I think, is another one that kind of illustrates how well they operated, because Marcio Amoroso, I think, is like a year older than the original Ronaldo. Ronaldo Nazario Lima, was that?
Yeah, nice.
There you go. But when he broke in, he was kind of like Ronaldo. You know how like Altafini was Pelé before Pelé? Marcio Amoroso was Ronaldo before Ronaldo. Except he suffered like some sort of devastating knee injury. Didn't play for like 15 months. I think it was actually like they botched the surgery. Everybody was doubtful about it. Came back, scored a few goals, but everybody was very doubtful about him. Udinese went and they did all this due diligence on the doctors who operated him, on what went on. They had people watching him in training every day until eventually they said, all right, let's roll the dice that this guy's going to be fine. And he comes over and, I mean, he wasn't quite Ronaldo, but he was pretty darn good. And they sold him for an absolute ton of money to, was it Borussia Dortmund, if I remember?
I think it was either Dortmund or Parma. I think he's still their record sale to this day, and that won't be adjusted for inflation either, I think. I think it was 28 million that they sold him for. But I think the Ronaldo comparison is quite appropriate because he was super quick. And one of the things that Zach does in this game is they soak up lots and lots of pressure, and then they just go long to Bierhoff, and Bierhoff's trademark was being excellent in the air, and he would flick it onto Amoroso. And they just could not cope with it. And they just, you know, hang on, what's going on? You know, we're playing 11v10 here and we keep getting stung like this. And yeah, that very much kind of helped make Zach's name right in Italian football. I mean, I think the job he'd got prior to this was
Cesena, no?
No, he was, sorry, he's from Cesenatico, which is right, the same city as Marco Pantani. But he had been in charge
Baraccalugo.
Baraccalugo.
Yeah.
Is that where he was before?
I don't know if that's where he was, but that's where he started.
Well, okay, so he started out there, but his previous job before going to Udinese was at Cosenza.
Ah, yeah.
And at Cosenza, ooh, I think they finish 15th in the second division. But just from, you know, sort of half-assed internet research, seems to have been a hell of a job because they had like a 9-point penalty for some kind of irregularities, whether it be, I don't know, fiddling things. But yeah, like a mini Mazzari, let's say, at Regina,
right,
back in the day.
He has a similarly huge impact at Udinese. He finishes
third. But
he's third,
so much nicer than Mazzari.
No, without
he's
doubt.
He's a lovely, lovely guy.
The tailor.
Yeah. Yeah, I
the
mean,
tailor. So basically, yeah, they finished third. Following season from that incredible Juve game, Bierhoff goes on the rampage, scores 27 goals in 32 appearances. And then he and Zaccheroni make the trip to and Helveg as well, Thomas Helveg. They all make the trip from
Danesino.
Il Danesino. Yeah, they make the move to Milan. It doesn't work out as well there. Berlusconi not impressed by
still win a title.
He wins the league. Zaccheroni.
Yeah, but do you remember Berlusconi was always having a pop at him?
Well, like, Berlusconi was like, you're a communist, yep, which was his thing. And then he was like, this is Milan. We only play 4-4-2 and we like a number 10 and you play with a back three. What's going on? And it's like, I've just won the league title, for God's sake. He's coached Milan, Inter and Juventus, which I think only Trapattoni has done that as well, which is pretty remarkable.
You're listening to Galazzo, the totally Italian football show.
Zaccheroni's Udinese were one of the classic iterations of the Zibretti of late, but there have been two others.
Well, I mean, the guy who replaced him when he went to Milan was Francesco Guidolin. And his first ball, I think they finished sixth, and Amoroso was top scorer, capocannoniere. But it didn't kind of work out. And then he came back many, many years later. And if people have already kind of forgotten how good this team was, so you can maybe compare them a little bit with Atalanta today in terms of a small team punching well above its weight. They're
also doing it with a ton of foreigners as well.
Yeah, which is what Atalanta are doing now. my point, Gab, I suppose, is, you know, Gasperini's what, in third or fourth year of his spell at Atalanta. The issue with these clubs is sustaining, you know, this ability to kind of punch above their weight. Yeah, you know, the first team that Gasper had at Atalanta was kind of, right, we've lost our first five games, we're going to play the kids. And then they have all these kids, and then they sell all those kids in January and May, and now they've got a team that's entirely full of kind of quite old, really good foreign players. Udinese, during this time, it was kind of almost all sort of finding really good foreign players, developing them. But their recruitment, as we saw with that mid-90s team, you're always going to have peaks and troughs, cycles. Your recruitment can't be flawless every time.
Sure. The second Guidolin spell, that 2010-2011 season, which was just, I mean, I think the greatest, in terms of numbers, Udinese's greatest season. They had the highest number of wins, most goals scored. They were just putting goals past everyone. 3-1 with Napoli, a 4-4 against Milan.
7-0.
They go to, and this is the extraordinary one, when they go to Palermo and score 7 goals against them, 4 of them from Alexis Sanchez.
Di Natale la fa passare per Sanchez, può andarsene tutto solo davanti a Sirigu. Sanchez, ancora Sanchez, e sono 3. Splendido gol di Alexis Sanchez.
And Di Natale finishes with 28 goals that season. You've got Handanovic in goal as well, who
Mehdi
spends...
Mehdi Benatia
at the back
when
as
he
well.
When he was really good.
Right. They finished fourth that year under Guidolin, and they go into the Champions League qualifiers, and where they meet Arsenal and it doesn't work out. The following season, same thing again, but this time they come up against Braga, and that there's the penalty kick business with, how do you say his name?
Michael Suell,
where he tries to Panenka.
Prova il cucchiaio, Michael Suell. Resta fermo Beto. Parte Ruben Michael e il Braga giocherà la fase a gironi della Champions. L'Udinese si arrende soltanto ai rigori.
Some people look at that and say that's where the glory years ended for Udinese.
Udinese never got over it. I mean, I suppose the really unfortunate thing is that team finished third, and today that would be good enough to get you automatically into the Champions League group stages. Back then, it got you into the playoffs, and we all know that playoffs tended to come before the season in Serie A had started. Italian teams were half-baked, the transfer window was still open, and yeah, they invariably went out.
So Michael Suell became like a bad word.
This was a qualifier with Braga, which Udinese were expected to go through, and it finishes the second leg in a penalty shootout, and he steps up and...
And the idiot does a Panenka. It's like, who do you think you are? But I was curious, he's obviously Brazilian, but like, giving your Brazilian roots, is Michael Suell a made-up name?
Is it like Maicon?
Maicon and Suellen, or I don't know. Have you ever encountered anybody named Michael Suell?
His name in the anagraph is Michael Suell Reginaldo de Matos. So it does appear to be his actual name as opposed to a nickname. But I don't know. Certainly it's not a name you want to utter too much around Udine. Because since then...
Did he go on to do anything?
That I know.
He haunts Francesco Guidolin.
But you know, no, but seriously, this was a club who, in the 19 seasons up to then, had qualified for European competition 11 times. Since that penalty kick, they've not been back once, and they've been certainly, I think the last five seasons have been in the bottom, finished in the bottom half.
It's almost like the Pozzo has bought Watford.
Yeah. Well, all right. So we'll come on to that. One thing I do want to mention, though, that this that incredibly golden period, and we haven't even touched on Spalletti's version of...
yeah, because Gap's here. We can't talk about Spalletti.
But that was another great side. You had Di Natale with Iaquinta back then, gun-toting Iaquinta, and some pretty excellent football. But they had this record, which I mentioned at the top, of the lowest away attendance ever. They played a game Sampdoria, and the gates are open, and one fan
that
turns
guy.
Up. One fan turns up. This guy who...
With the Friulian flag.
Arrigo Brovedani. Yeah. So he basically, I mean, it's just extraordinary. I mean, you'd expect maybe a handful of fans to make it. This was a Serie A match. One fan turned up and sat there the entire match on his own, in the entire kind of one end of the tribuna of the Marassi.
We should point out, right? So part of the reason. So Udine as a town. I mean, you mentioned all the different influences. There's some like industry there. It's not like Veneto. They never went through a period where they were really poor, but they're just kind of content to be left alone. And the countryside around there is all flat. It's really cold. And it gets really, really foggy. Now, I know people will point out that it's like that in Padania, where I'm from, in the area around Milan.
You don't like the solitudine.
It's nothing like that. I spoke to somebody who was involved in their youth academy, which I believe has produced zero top-flight football.
No?
Yeah. Am I forgetting somebody?
Well, at the moment, the goalkeeper of Napoli is Alex Meret.
That's right.
He's also Friulian, and I think Scuffet, who was
Meret and Scuffet, yeah.
Yeah.
Remember Scuffet they thought was going to be really good? He goes to Atletico Madrid, and anyway. So, yeah, okay. They haven't produced any actual footballers, just the odd goalkeeper. But they said that they went through this one phase where, taking advantage of different loopholes, they had brought in, this is back when rules were a lot more liberal, they brought in a whole bunch of players from West Africa to go with the local players from Friuli. Because one of the reasons was the local players, because there aren't very many of them, they had nobody to play against, and the level was poor. So that was their excuse, right? In reality, obviously, they said, oh, let's bring in these African kids and see who develops. But then the fog would roll in, and they were just all so miserable all day. And they ended up abandoning the project and actually often training indoors.
Gap mentions the West African connection.
You're going to tell the passport story?
No, La Mossa Vincente for Zaccheroni was to bring on the Ghanaian Mohamed Gargo for Thomas Locatelli in that 3-0 winner. You look at some of the Ghanaians that they've had over the years, Asamoah Gyan, Kwadwo Asamoah, Stephen Appiah.
This is a good one. And Stephen Appiah, by the way, like at 18, he looked like a world beater.
So many great names, so many great seasons. And as I say, we haven't even mentioned Spalletti. He was the first guy to get them into the Champions League back in the early noughties, Gab.
Yes, of course, this was a different Spalletti. In the same way that Mr. Kurtz was a brilliant employee of the company before he went upriver in Heart of Darkness, so too was that Spalletti before he went off to the wilds of St. Petersburg. This guy was a personable, super talented coach who achieved wonders with Roma and other clubs, but originally I think made his name at probably as much as Udinese, or even before that. He was at Samp and Empoli.
He famously kind of took Samp down.
So that was slightly unfortunate. The Samp season, he was there, and then Enrico Mantovani fired him with them above the relegation zone, and Mantovani brought in his place David Platt.
Platy, and
a disastrous set of results saw the club precipitated down into the bottom three, at which point Platt left and Spalletti came back in. Two stints at the same club in the same season is a tricky also repeated with another football's most loyal presidents, Maurizio Zamparini at Venezia, where he was fired and then rehired and then fired again, all in the space of one season. But at Udine, at least, he was a success. And as you mentioned, at Roma, he was tactically groundbreaking.
Maybe we should have an episode about Spalletti.
Spalletti, yeah. Always.
We should also remind people that, so here in England, when a manager gets sacked, he goes and he issues a statement via the LMA website, which nobody reads, but unfortunately I'm on their mailing list, so I get all these sort of statement from Paul Dickov, but whatever. But what generally happens is here in England, they negotiate a payoff when they're gone. In Italy, no, they stay under contract because it's cheaper for the clubs to just keep paying them. Mm. And then when somebody else then wants to come in for them, then that way they can charge compensation. Mm. But of course, when you keep paying them, it'll also mean that if you're, you know, one of those unfortunate owners and you decide to sack managers, hey, look, I've sacked managers for the third time this season. I know, I don't want to pay any more money. I'll just bring in one of the old guys. So you've got people like Davide Ballardini who seemingly, like, you know, stay under contract forever and keep coming back to different clubs.
Mm. Ballardini's probably still on retainer at Cagliari and Palermo.
At the same time, yeah.
Magnificent. Anyway, Udinese, you mentioned the fact that recent years have not been so kind to the Zibretti, and some people point to that penalty miss as a turning point, but James, as you mentioned, the bigger issue has been the fact that the Pozzos have found themselves a new toy to play with, the toy by the name of Watford.
Yeah, I mean, just looking at some of Watford's signings, some of them do strike me as classic Udinese signings at a time when the transfer market wasn't so inflated. For example, I could completely see Richarlison one day, yeah, sort of going to Udinese. But if you look at what they...
Sorry, on the Richarlison, though, this is a good indication of what we mentioned before, Alexis Sanchez, of the way these guys operate. Mm. When they find somebody they really like, they will go and blow the budget. I mean, they spent 20 million, I think, on Richarlison, which, you know, for Watford was a ton of money, in the same way that they spent 3 million on a 16-year-old Alexis Sanchez. And I think that's part of the secret. The way they evaluate players is very much in terms of value. So if they think you're a 5 million euro player and they can get you for 2 million, they'll do it. Equally, if they think you're a 50 million euro player, they can get you for 20 million, they will push the boat out. And that's something that's worked for them and I think allowed them to sign players who would ordinarily go to bigger clubs.
Just briefly, the reason that buying Watford would have such an impact on Udinese, what would that be?
Having a club in the richest league in the world, which, yeah, they got that club there, is ultimately much better for a family whose business is football than Udinese these days.
Right. It diverted attention. It also diverted players. There was a certain movement of players up the kind of Pozzo pyramid, the other club that were, for a while, part of that.
Britos's.
Granada.
Your Beramis.
Yeah, Matteo Vidra. Yeah.
Although...
Reneghi's.
We should point out that, officially... this is not a multi-ownership situation.
No.
Because one Pozzo owns Udinese and his son owns the other one. So these are two very separate entities.
Well, for now, it's Giampaolo Pozzo who remains in charge of Udinese. Something tells me, Gab, that you'd like to sign off with a little Pozzo anecdote.
Very minor thing, but Udinese, to their credit, were also one of the first, in the newest batch, were one of the first Italian clubs to go and invest money in their stadium. I don't think they quite build a new stadium, but they remodeled the Stadio Friuli under some sort of long-term lease where they put the money in. Two things about this. One is they colored all the seats, yeah. So even when it's empty, it doesn't look like rubbish. It doesn't look like, you know, the San Paolo, which looks like a desert. The other thing is, even before that, you talked about their innovation. I think they were one of the first clubs in Europe to build, I don't use the plural luxury boxes, but they had one luxury box, at least, with sort of this sort of dark glass. And you could look, and during the games, they'd always put, the camera would always get trained on the glass. And my injury memory is seeing Giampiero Pozzo, usually dressed in black with his big white Ken Batesian beard, sitting in one of those giant office chairs that, like, would swivel in this room, but, like, literally by himself, watching the game behind the glass.
Like that lone fan at Sampdoria.
Eating some San Daniele ham or something, you know.
All right, Zico aside, who's been Udinese's greatest player?
Di Natale.
Totò Di Natale, yeah.
Fair. And listener, if you'd like to know why Gab and James are so swift in that affirmation, you only need to go back and listen to our very special Galazzo on Anthony Christmas. There you go, Udinese. I hope, you know, whatever it is, the Pozzos rediscover their love for the Zibretti.
Well,
or...
this is the thing. I mean, I think one of the... Andrea Carnivale, who was up front with Maradona back at Napoli, he's their kind of head of scouting, has claimed that Y-Scout killed Udinese.
Oh, right, because everyone can do it.
Because everyone can do it. They don't have to be at these under-17 World Cups or these sub-20 or sub-21 tournaments in South America. You know, you can pretty much watch them from your... you know, laptop in Stoke.
Will we see their like again? I don't know. But for now, that's been the Udinese story. If you've enjoyed it, do check out our other Golazzo podcasts, touching on such diverse topics as Pippo Inzaghi and legendary Italian TV show Il Processo. There's loads of other great ones as well, Zola. Loads for you to enjoy, listener. We'll sign off with that. For now, from James, Gabriele and myself, it's arrivederci. Campionato di calcio
italiano. You've been listening to Golazzo, the totally Italian football show. It's a Muddy Knees Media production, and for sales and advertising, please email sales@muddyneesmedia.com. Check out our other football shows on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Audioboom, and everywhere else you get your audio on demand.